Kamik, were you appointed in this case?
No, sir.
No, I... Okay. Thank you. Court will proceed to the sixth case, the United States versus Shutt.
This guy was appointed. This guy wasn't appointed.
Mr. Edmund?
The crowd is thinned out. The crowd is thinned out.
Good morning. May it please the court,
Mr. Blakeman.
This case comes to you, Your Honor, to ask you to review the sentence imposed on Mr. Sharp in this case. And there are three issues that converge here for your consideration, I think. One is the idea of notice under the Sinkowski case as cited by the government, Rule 32 of Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, Section 6A1.3 of the sentencing guidelines. The second issue is the definition and the elements involving acceptance of responsibility and obstruction of justice and how they were applied to this unique set of facts. And three, perhaps, is the reasonableness of the sentence. Very briefly, the facts are this, Judge. Mr. Sharp was targeted by a confidential informant who informed the local Metropolitan Drug Task Force in Indianapolis. This informed the task force that Mr. Sharp was dealing cocaine. They set up the informant. He makes three or four buys, relatively small amounts. A warrant is procured. A search is done. There's a kilogram of cocaine in the basement, some marijuana in the house, also a gun. Not long after Mr. Sharp is arrested, he gives a full and complete statement in the eyes of the government. And keep in mind, this is unique in a federal prosecution, Your Honor. This is the Metropolitan Drug Task Force in Indianapolis is basically a local group that works under the auspices of the DEA and the U.S. Attorney's Office, but they're not geared up to do the extensive conspiracy-type investigations that you see every day. And so they had no other evidence about Mr. Sharp. So everything that Mr. Sharp told the detectives Foster and Maxey within hours after he's arrested, everything that he told them is everything that the government knows about his past. So when this comes into issue at the sentencing hearing, there's no independent evidence that the government can present as far as corroboration of what their position is. Just keep that in mind when we get to the sentencing hearing. Sharp is released. A plea agreement is worked out fairly quickly. The sentencing is delayed because of Blakely and Booker. And so the sentencing is post-Booker. The sentencing was not held for several months. At the sentencing, Mr. Sharp kind of backs out of some of what he had told the government originally.
You mean he tells a different story?
Kind of.
Well, not he admits kind of, to being, either does or he doesn't. That's well, like being a little pregnant, either you are or you aren't.
I know. But keep in mind, Judge, and I missed something here, what the construct, this is where notice comes in. The construct of the sentencing hearing was only to argue about the gun that I told you was found in his house.
Uh-huh.
You know, the two-level enhancement that involves when a gun and drugs are in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Sharp's lawyer puts him on the stand.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about the gun. He talks about how it's held for personal protection. Mr. Glickman, representing the government, cross-examines Mr. Sharp very broadly. And Mr. Sharp at some point says that the length of time that he had been dealing wasn't what the government had believed it to be.
But it was in what he had said originally.
Well, he had essentially this. He had said he'd been dealing...
You know, the President of the United States once quibbled about the definition of the word is, but I mean, I don't think we should get to that point.
No.
If he told a different story about the amount of cocaine, go ahead, say so.
Well, the catch-22 is this. If he had kept his mouth shut, they would not have known what he had
done at all.
Isn't
that the fact? Even a fish wouldn't get caught for to keep its mouth shut.
I know, but he had been caught. I mean, but look at the irony here.
Yeah.
I mean, he gets caught. They don't know any more about him other than he's
tells got, all.
He's got a kilo in a basement,
yeah.
And he's done three transactions of probably, and Mr. Glidden might have to help.
It's the stupidity of the criminal class that has made the prosecution a little easier. But.
And so the question becomes, what's that stupidity worth in the way of a sentence?
There you go. If the stupidity leads to lying, however, about your participation in the crime, then you got a different problem.
But the problem is that the relevant conduct that everybody, that everyone is telling Judge Tinder is the truth, is also came from my client's mouth.
I know. You lied about one way or another. You lied.
So you, what we have here is a sentence that would start at 10 years because the amounts that they know about. Would actually be a guideline lower than the minimum mandatory. All right, the kilo and the three or four transactions would have put him probably at level 28 or maybe level 30. That would have brought him under 10 years, so his sentence would have had to have been 10 years. By giving a full and complete statement, he increases that exposure to a level, I think, 34. Then, which Mr. Glickman argues. I mean, he argues that as the truth. I guess what I'm coming down to is you can't have it both ways. I mean, if the government feels that that is what Mr. Sharp is responsible for, then he's accepted that responsibility from day one. He assisted the government. I mean, the policy issues on acceptance are that, and I know you've heard these many times. I know you've been involved in many assessments of sentences, but he was great assistance to the government to the point that they conducted no further investigation. He pled quickly. All of the bells and whistles that go into the acceptance of responsibility were there. They were there from day one. He didn't obstruct justice. If the obstruction of justice has to do with finding out what he had done, that's what he did. And he cooperated. He cooperated in giving the government the original statement and the original amounts, and that's what they relied on. And they were satisfied in that reliance. And this is distinct from the cases cited by the government as far as acceptance of responsibility is concerned. They cite Travis, Gage, Camoga, Burke. All four of those cases involve Travis's told probation. He was a con man. He tells probation he didn't intend to defraud anybody. Camoga had done many counterfeit checks and only admitted to a couple. Burke was, a lawyer, actually. He violated a consent decree that was against him while he was out. And then Grimm has some language in it, and I'd ask the court to review that, 170 Fed 3rd at 766 and 767, which Judge Flaum had written, talking about the need for some corroborative evidence in this context. Grimm is very similar to this case.
Why is any of that case law relevant post-Booker when the judge has complete discretion to exceed a guideline sentence?
Because the fact is that determining the guidelines, even in an advisory capacity, determines the sentence that Judge Tinder, in this case, believed was reasonable. I mean, I don't think that the 3553 factors, which I understand are overriding, ignore the guidelines. I still, even though we're saying that these are advisory, they carry a little more weight because they are presumed to be reasonable. So if any district court judge that makes that determination under the guidelines uses those guidelines 95% of the time because they're presumed to be reasonable.
Right, but we had a guideline sentence here that was correctly calculated and the judge declined to give the acceptance of responsibility downward departure that everybody thought was going to be forthcoming because of what happened during the sentencing hearing. And even pre-Booker, he was free to not award that credit, if you will. But certainly post-Booker, the judge was free to decline to give the defendant credit for acceptance of responsibility.
Yeah, but the discussion by Judge Tinder shows that he went through the mechanics of acceptance of responsibility and obstruction of justice.
That's not binding on us because he went through the mechanics of doing it. If we find that his decision was reasonable, then that's the end of it, right?
Once again, it's a catch-22 as far as I'm concerned as a defense attorney. It's very difficult to determine the acceptance of responsibility is built into the guidelines to give the defendant an opportunity to express remorse, and more importantly, to assist the government. And when that is the only evidence of his relevant conduct, which was also important to the determination of the sentence, of his past history, then I think that, I think that holds the government to at least some standard to be able to present to the court some evidence above and beyond what the defendant has given them. I mean, he is the one that solved the history of his criminal activity for them, and they believe that to be true. My time's up.
Thank you, Mr. Inman. Mr. Glickman?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Barry Glickman. I represent the United States of America in this case. Just to briefly respond to some things that Mr. Inman brought up, I do agree with Mr. Inman that after Mr. Sharp was arrested, he gave a full and complete statement that detailed the relevant conduct in this case. Mr. Sharp, in his post-arrest statement, indicated that he had been dealing a kilogram of cocaine a month for the past 18 months. Mr. Sharp indicated that he had started dealing drugs when he was 28 years old, which would be some 14 years from the time that he was arrested, and also indicated that he had been cooking crack for the past 2 years. Based on that, a plea agreement was entered into between the United States and Mr. Sharp, whereas certain things were agreed to. One of the things that was agreed to was the base offense level in this case, which in this case was 34. Under the now advisory sentencing guidelines, to get to a base offense level 34, that encompasses between 15 and 50 kilograms of cocaine. That's very important because that's what the parties agreed to in the plea agreement, and that's what Mr. Sharp agreed to in the plea agreement, and that's what Mr. Sharp
Did he agree to the time or did he agree to the amount?
He agreed, Your Honor, in the plea agreement that the proper base offense level in this case was 34.
Now he's talking about time now. He's not talking about the amount of narcotics involved.
No, there was no mention in the plea agreement of the amount of narcotics.
That was my understanding.
But, yes, and that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. But, as I indicated earlier, that would have had to have involved a minimum of 15 kilograms of cocaine going on up to 50 kilograms of cocaine. At the plea colloquy, Judge Tinder took evidence from Detective Foster of the Metropolitan Drug Task Force, wherein he detailed what I had just indicated to the court and detailed Mr. Sharp's full and complete post-arrest statement, which Mr. Sharp did not contest. Judge Tinder gave him the opportunity to, and he did not contest. That was in April of 2004. The sentencing occurred in January of 2005, and as Mr. Inman correctly pointed out, that was to let the Blakely and Booker dust settle. At the sentencing, Mr. Sharp got up on the witness stand and under oath gave false testimony to the district court. The district court found that Mr. Sharp gave false testimony on a material issue. Indicated Mr. Sharp now contended that he was only dealing for 1.5 years, that he had only dealt 5 kilograms of cocaine and not the not over 15 as would have been required by the base offense level. Now, the central contention in Mr. Sharp's brief is that he did not receive notice that these guideline adjustments for a downward adjustment for acceptance of responsibility and an upward adjustment for obstruction of justice were going to be tacked on. I would respectfully suggest to the court that it would have been metaphysically impossible for Judge Tinder to have given any type of notice that these issues were even in play. And the reason is Mr. Sharp had, up to that point, accepted responsibility and did not obstruct justice.
Well, even aside from the metaphysical impossibility that you're arguing here, does that notice rule in Rule 32 have any operation post-Booker?
It's a good question, Your Honor. It's a very good question.
You didn't speak to that in your brief. I don't know if the government has a position about that. It seems to me that's kind of an important issue going forward.
It's certainly an open question. I believe there's a Tenth Circuit case called Mayo, M-A-Y-O, that addresses it. I'm sorry, it's Monroy, M-O-N-R-O-Y, Monroy, that indicates that 32H at least is still viable after Booker. But the fact of the matter is that the defendant was on notice by virtue of entering into the plea agreement and having gone through the rule colloquy that these were potential issues. I would respectfully point the court to the provision in the plea agreement, which is located on page 10 of the appendix, that deals with acceptance of responsibility. And it conditionally granted Mr. Sharp acceptance of responsibility. It says, in the event that he continues to accept responsibility for his criminal conduct, the defendant shall receive an adjustment for accepting responsibility, which he clearly did not do by his false testimony at the sentencing hearing. And additionally, the defendant was on notice that there could be, that obstruction of justice might be in play. That's located on page 12 of the appendix, and in the plea agreement, right above the signature line, which is the last provision of the plea agreement, it indicates, finally, my attorney has informed me, and I understand that if I provide or cause to be provided materially false information to a judge, magistrate, judge, or probation officer, then U.S. Sentencing Guideline 3C1.1 allows the court to impose a two-level increase in the base offense level. So Mr. Sharp was on notice that these issues were potentially in play. This is not a situation like the case in Sienkowski where the parties had agreed to an enhancement and the district judge decided that there was no evidence for it. Basically, the issues of acceptance of responsibility and obstruction of justice did not come into play until Mr. Sharp testified falsely. Judge Tinder put him on notice after the false testimony, made the requisite findings, and as the court has previously indicated, calculated a proper guideline sentence. And based on this court's case in McKittyuk, Mr. Sharp has offered and cannot offer any reason why that's an unreasonable sentence. And based on that, I would ask this court to uphold the judgment of Judge Tinder and affirm Mr. Sharp's sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. Mr. Inman, your time had expired, but if you need a minute to respond to anything, you may have it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I can't help but be struck about the common sense operation of Mr. Sharp's case. If he keeps his mouth shut, which I understand he was advised of his Miranda rights, but if he doesn't give the government the information they wish, originally he gets 10 years because the amounts would have been below the statutory minimum. He wouldn't have gotten a 5K1. He wouldn't have gotten a safety valve because of the gun that was in the house, so it would have gone up to 10 years. By attempting to cooperate, which he did fully, because the government relies on that as gospel in their argument in sentencing, and then waffling some, not really to any great extent. He doesn't say that he wasn't dealing amounts of cocaine, that he wasn't making any money. His sentence goes to close to 20 years. It's 235 months. That does not seem to be just to me. And it's that gut-level feeling that I have that brings me here. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Inman. Thank you, Mr. Glickman. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.